You're listening to Podcast on Fire. It's Asian cinema in a podcast with your hosts, the magnificent trio of Stu, Ken, and Mike.
Hello and welcome to Podcast on Fire. I am your host, Stuart Sutherland. Joining me this evening, we have Ken.
Hello.
And we have Mike Banner.
I am your father.
Yeah, I thought somebody's fucking porno link just cut into the mic.
Holding my breath.
This show is basically our conclusion to the Visible Secrets coverage on podcastandfire.com. The Manchester's Cinema House, Corner House, have been showing a season of Hong Kong movies from notable female directors. To close the season, they screen Claustrophobia, starring Karina Lam and Ekin Cheng.
Noodles!
The movie was directed by female writer and director Ivy Ho. Paul Loudon, who was one of our guests from the anniversary special a few shows back, recorded an exclusive interview with Ivy Ho. So once we've covered our last movies watched, we're going to give a brief rundown of Ivy Ho's filmography and then run the interview. So, last movies watched. Ken?
Alright, we're doing Ivy Ho-related last movies watched. We should state beforehand.
No.
We should not state that beforehand, okay. Consider it non-stated there. I actually watched a Ivy Ho-related movie, funnily enough.
Really? How coincidental. Yeah.
How coincidental indeed. All right. One that she wrote. I haven't seen Claustrophobia yet because I'm dependent on DVD releases, and I don't think it's out yet. And if it is, I simply haven't bought it yet. So I went back to one of the movies she wrote for An Hui called Goddess of Mercy from 2003, which is the movie that was made after July Rhapsody, which Ivy Ho wrote and An Hui directed, and Paul reviewed that movie for the Podcast on Fire site, and thought it was a rather good movie, and I can wholeheartedly agree with that. Goddess of Mercy is a mixed bag, actually, of An Hui's own style and a bit of commercial style thrown in with it, and when they collide and mix, it turns out to be the result is a draw in a way, which is not entirely bad, but it's not entirely good either. So basic plot is, I'll read off my own plot that I wrote once upon a time here. Being pestered by yuppie playboy Yang Rui, a lowly cleaner at a taekwondo gym, He Yandong, played by Vicky Xiao, which is the girl from Shaolin Soccer and So Close, she eventually budges and invites Yang into her single mother life. Feeling stable for the first time in many years, she is soon reminded of the events that led her to this place, events that involved the death of her husband, and she pushes the devoted Yang Rui away when she reveals that she was once an active drug enforcement officer called An Qin. So it's a movie played out partly in flashback, as it turns out. And even before July Rhapsody, An Hui played a commercial game quite a bit with Visible Secret, the 2001 horror romance with Eason Chan and Xu Kei. And it was followed by July Rhapsody, sort of a layered, taboo-ridden drama, if you will. And then Goddess of Mercy, as I said, seems to mix the areas recently visited, and also, therefore, is still more of a true An Hui movie that occasionally features the gloss of a gunplay thriller. So, and it's it was made in mainland China, so it's a Mandarin movie, and it's kind of a downbeat portrait of devotion that is quite interesting, but it ends up, as I said, struggling with its arty and commercial style. And one of the, I think, many viewers would be let's say, frustrated a little bit with the movie because it's vague and mysterious, almost to the point of, you know, too vague and mysterious about the soft-spoken Vicky Chow character. And there's also kind of plentiful to be annoyed by in the character of Yang Roy, which is very much this yuppie dickhead who won't acknowledge 100 no's from a woman. You know, it basically initially stands for all that's wrong with the, you know, the skirt-chasing male, if you will. Mm-hmm. And something happens that isn't very explained, but I'll buy it still, that he falls for this girl and basically consciously degrades himself in the name of devotion for the first time. You know, he wants to take care of her. Actually, he's not just looking to get into her pants, and the voiceover says that basically this is the first time I've never felt to just, you know, have sex and go. I don't want to have sex. I want to take care of this girl. And it's slightly vague motivation, and therefore it's a challenge in the Ivanhoe script to justify this. And the work is, you know, half and half in a way. It's good, and it's also not good. And when we cut to the flashback, the darker sections of the film, after Yang Roy is pushed away, we learn that it has very much to do with the character Nicolas Tse plays, this drug dealer that she falls in love with. And I obviously won't reveal what happens there, but she's, you can say, despite being aided by this necklace she has, the Goddess of Mercy, any involvement with this drug dealer will spell doom, and any mercy directed upon her character, An Chin, will be in the form of being reclusive. You know, loneliness is the only mercy here in this world, this very cynical, bloody world. And much bloodshed later, this message is hammered home very hard. But it's a decent, gory drama, and also low-key in the trademark An Hui way, where it's not arty and abstract, but very, like, she just lets the camera roll, and either we pick up on what's there or we don't, either we engage or we don't, and therefore I like that style, and I like that style in this movie, and therefore I like Vicky Chow's performance, because she's suitably in tune in that, sort of plays an introvert, speaking softly, and she's also a believable action heroine when needed. Overall, though, it's a step down from July Rhapsody, obviously, because it wants to please dual audiences, you know, commercial audience and the An Hui audience, and the An Hui audience isn't the commercial audience. But she doesn't abandon a lot of who she really is, stylistically or as a social commentator, and that social commentary is not very overbearing. It's there if you want to get it, but so it's not overbearing, as I said. But the gory pessimism might be too overbearing for some, and there's some really heinous violence in this film, especially from Nicolas Tse. The worst piece of violence he commits is off screen, thankfully, but it's kind of a controversial image in the film. And Hoy being this angry, it's not a uncommon thing, though. So, it's a very watchable film. I rewatched it for this podcast, and I still like it, but I still stand by that. It does things good overall, but also it's every now and again within the film. So, I mean, it's admirable to try to mix who you are, you know, a commercial director and a art house director, let's say. Mm. But I don't think many people, when they see the cover, some romantic stills, will expect this much bloodshed and violence. And that might be alluring to people too, to watch this harshness on display. So there you are. And in terms of Ivanhoe's work, I think she's never written this much darkness in a film ever. So I guess that was a challenge also to either get out some things out of her system, or just try something out. You know, a romance with a dark twist. I believe she says in the interview, "I'm quite fed up with writing romance." So White News does, why not turn the tables? So that's it.
Okay, Mike?
It's interesting you should say about a character who's a womanizer and then meets a girl and it's the first time, you know, he doesn't want to cheat on her, you know, he's in love with her, blah, 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 blah. So that's exactly what happens to Aaron Kwok's character in Anna Magdalena, which is the Ivy Ho written film that I watched. Right then.
Oh.
So now, this kind of has a rom-com setup, which is there's Takashi Kaneshiro, who's a kind of boring, sort of lonely piano tuner. Keeps himself to himself, doesn't really do much interesting. Who goes to tune a piano at an apartment where Aaron Kwok is splitting up with his girlfriend. And so it ends up that Aaron Kwok is like this bubbly charmer, kind of very charismatic, but all he's got is like a sun-kissed box full of a few of his possessions. And he's just a bit of a, you know, a bit of a dreamer, a bit of a bum, sort of, and a moocher. And he ends up staying with Takeshi Kaneshiro at his apartment. And then a new neighbour in the form of Kelly Chen moves up upstairs. And both men seem kind of interested in her. That's the story. So it's kind of got a rom-com setup. You've got, like, you know, the straight kind of main character, maybe like the everyman. Then there's the kind of fun charmer kind of role character. And then Kelly Chen being, you know, attractive and a woman. Who's kind of like, oh, I'm not falling for your shtick, mate. You know, a bit of a love triangle, sort of. Except, it's not really a rom-com. It's packed with art house pretension. Which means it's slow and boring. And the kind of film where you have multiple characters staring out of windows at different points in the film. Looking longingly into the middle distance while some music swells up in the background. Also, it's pretty pretentiously as well. It's broken up sort of into chapters, which are described as movements, as it's supposed to. Is you know, it's a lot of back in there, especially one particular tune and references to classical music and whatever. oh, I don't know where to start because this film is absolutely terrible.
No, it's not.
And I'm having difficulty knowing where to begin. Okay, first up, zero believability in any of the characters. The Aaron Kwok obviously has, you know, the most fun because he's got a more interesting character. But the reason why, you know, he falls in love with Kelly Chen, never really explained, doesn't seem to really, it's not really there. It's just there because it says so in the script. He's got no real depth. You don't know anything about his character at all. Then the Kelly Chen character doesn't do anything whatsoever through the whole film. Whinge a little bit about, oh, you know, I always fall for these kind of guys, but, you know, oh, maybe he'll be different. That's about it. Then Takeshi Kaneshiro, you assume, is the kind of, you know, the main guy in the film, yet he's so uninteresting. I guess you're supposed to feel, you know, no, he's missed out on the girl, or he's missed out on the girl, he doesn't know what to do, poor Takeshi, but no, none of that. Just no depth to him, no emotion, no real connection. And the pace of the film, it's paced like a really dull art house flick. In fact, it's about as slow and dull as Takeshi's character. And then what happens is there's kind of a story within a story in the film, which is more of a fantasy. Well, it's a fantasy kind of thing. And you think maybe, you know, okay, you know, have a bit of fun with that. The characters don't have, you know, can break out and do something different. But no, it's just as dull as the rest of the film and pointless and pretentious. The dialogue's okay, but there's just, like I said, no depth and no believability to any of the characters whatsoever. It feels kind of disjointed and scrappy as well. just hopping from scene to scene, which don't seem to make much sense. Overall, an absolute sack of shit. It actually made me angry because the film was so bad.
Sound angry.
Afterwards, I was like, I can't believe I was actually made to watch this film. And the other thing that was going through my head is that Andrew Sarek, who is one of the writers at FarEastFilms.com, who I respect and like his writing and usually respect his opinions, he actually gave this film 5 stars. So, I mean, if you want to read an opinion of somebody who liked the film, obviously a whole lot, you can go to FarEastFilms.com and look under reviews and find Anna Magdalena. But I kept thinking, how? I don't get how. Also, a side note, this hasn't got anything to do with the film, but the Universe DVD from Hong Kong, which is what I've got, has got the fastest subs I've ever seen in any film. There's so many occasions where they're up so quickly and off so quickly that you can't read them. They're ridiculously quick. And, ooh, just like with, what was that crap I watched with Donnie Yen? Satan Returns, that I reviewed on here. I think it was Satan Returns. Yeah. It's got missing subtitles. Why would you sub? It's a 98-minute film. Why would you sub like 94 minutes but not sub 4 minutes in the middle of it? I don't get it. So there's like a conversation between two female characters where they swap a few sentences and none of it is subtitled. Really winds me up. And that was just, you know, the ball of crap on the crap pie.
What do you expect from Hong Kong companies if we're talking technical? I mean, it's a grave error to make, but it's no use to getting angry about that. There's just another, you know, on that major list of what kind of errors on Hong Kong DVDs.
I can forgive, like, grammatical errors and spelling errors and things like that. But, you know, just not having the subs there, I don't know how they do that. How it comes about where you just don't spot it, or, you know, the person who's doing the subs thinks, ah, fuck it, I can't be bothered. Crack open a beer, skip a couple of minutes.
That is the attitude. Believe it or not, you're spot on. In many ways, across the different aspects of presenting Hong Kong cinema and DVD, that is the attitude, and it's not bound to change anytime soon. And therefore, I don't get angry about it anymore. I just accept it for what it is, because we here on the internet geeks are too small and too insignificant to change anything. I'm not referring to you or anything, Mike, but to many others who think there's something to better in terms of presenting Hong Kong cinema on DVD. It's a valid point to try and make things better, but you realize that it's not bound to change anytime soon. It's not Japanese cinema we're dealing with here. It's not the luxury of Japanese cinema. And it never will be luxury of that.
To all lazy Hong Kong subtitlers, I shake my fist at you.
And now finally they get it.
Oh, yes, the film's rubbish. I wouldn't bother watching it if I was you. In fact, I took the DVD out of my DVD player as quick as possible in case there was some kind of poo film disease that it gave my DVD player. Might infect one of my beautiful, beautiful Shaw Brothers films next time it's in.
What, did you just break it soon after?
No, I'm going to try and sell it to some hapless doofus. Hey, have you got a copy of Anna Magdalena, Stu?
No, but I would pay you, say, £2.50 to record a film of you destroying it. And then we'll put it on the website.
Interesting.
Yep. I don't even care if it's mobile phone quality. Get someone to hold it. Get yourself a hammer.
I think it's an interesting way to break it. Okay. Break it down. Punish
our fans,
it.
People on the forum, tweet us. Or, okay, wait.
That's a very nice thing. That's a very nice attitude we have towards the guest that's coming on later in the show here.
Well, I actually thought to myself afterwards. I said that to Jenny after I'd watched it, my girlfriend. I'm really glad I didn't have to do the interview with Ivy Ho now, because if this film got mentioned or somebody asked me about it, then I'd be forced to tell him how utterly, utterly bollocks it was. And that could have been awkward.
That could have been an honest discussion as well. You never know.
I can't find a redeeming quality in the film. I'm assuming you've got a different opinion on it then, Ken.
I liked half of it. And I bear in mind, but I don't think I've changed my opinion much, but bear in mind I watched it like 7 years ago now, or something like that. One of the very first reviews I wrote. But I didn't mind the basic rom-com setup. I thought I was infectious enough. You know, it's not grade A stuff. 5 stars is way too generous for the film, personally. But I like the atmosphere, the simple atmosphere. I was on board with the Takeshi Kaneshiro character. Could agree that the Aaron Kwok character is not that interesting. And in terms of boring art house, I mean, my personal definition of that is, this is not at all close to boring art house. I think Mr. Wong Kar-wai is the representation of that. But, it's down to how you view art house, obviously.
Art house pretensions. It feels like it wants to be an art house, right, kind of romantic film.
Mm. But there are certain aspects, the chapter headings or transition, it's not really, meaningful as such. And the transfer into fantasy, I wasn't really on board with then. And even though you get the, the reason for it at the end of the film, I was never really convinced that was a choice to go with at all. The only thing I liked about that fantasy sequence was they either legally borrowed the score from, well, having said that, it's the same piece of music that appears in Terry Gilliam's Brazil, but that was not the original composed piece of music that maybe that was existing music, but many people recognize it from Brazil, so I was like, hey, that's from Brazil.
A better film.
Yeah, obviously that's a better film. I don't think I would rewatch it as such. I there's tons of more simple rom-coms with these basic setups that are so affecting and so enjoyable. But I didn't mind half of this. And that's the first half.
The thing is, though, it's not calm. Maybe you can argue the romance angle of it, but it's not funny. At the beginning, there was a couple of little chortly moments that I quite liked. But after that, no. No jokes.
I think I would agree that just a romantic drama. I basically say rom-com per default, you know what I mean? Without thinking, wait a minute, that wasn't funny.
Well, I said that because it's got that kind of setup, though.
Yeah.
It's got the depth of character that a lot of rom-coms have. But I wouldn't mind it so much, if there was fairly flat characters, as long as, it was funny and it was an entertaining ride and it wasn't, the ambition was fairly low. Mm. Whereas the ambition feels too lofty for what it can even come close to achieving.
It's the debut of Yi Chung Man, which is a famous art director in Hong Kong. He made 2 movies up to this point, which may explain thinking too about the look of it and the choices as an art director. It's a good art director.
There's a Peter Powder in the cinematography on it as well.
Yes.
Yeah, it looks nice. And possibly too nice on a couple of occasions. It kind of resembled like a perfume ad or something. It felt a bit, a bit too slick almost. See, my only point of praise turned out to be a negative.
and now you're off to Far East Films to create a forum thread directed to Andrew. What were you thinking?
No, I feel pretty good for ripping into it on air, actually. I feel quite unburdened.
Yeah, you can breathe.
It's like I've just had a big poo.
Well, I could have done without that.
I could make a South Park reference there, but I won't.
No one needs to make any more references.
Do you feel like unburdening yourself, Stuart?
Well, I don't hold a burden. I'm a free spirit. Yeah. Well, I had originally chose to. Well, when it comes to Ivy Home movies, I think everyone is right. Stuart's going to watch Divergence.
Again.
Or, get his hands on Claustrophobia, but. As Kevin said, I don't even know if it's out on DVD
Did you go against type, Stu?
Go against type?
Yeah.
I'm a free spirit.
There we go. So how did this free spiritness manifest itself in your movie watching?
Well, it basically gave up and ended up watching The Accidental Spy. Did somebody just throw up in their own mouth there?
I didn't.
Well, no, I haven't even seen The Accidental Spy.
Okay.
So what was Miss Ho's, I assume this is an Ivy Ho film. Well, I know it is, so I don't know why I'm saying that.
Yep.
It was written by her.
Yes. Let's see.
First action movie. She's written.
Let's see, I've got the plot up here. For those that don't know, The Accidental Spy is a big Jackie Chan vehicle from back in 2001. Jackie Chan is Bay, and the international print is Buck. Buck Hugh. It makes him sound like half Texan, half Chinese.
Buck you.
Mm-hmm. See, there's this. Oh. Okay, but that's me blaming the people that done the international release. For the normal release, he is just Bay. Bay is a less than successful exercise equipment salesman who yearns for excitement in his life. One day, Bay follows his instincts and trails two suspicious-looking men into action and foils their plans. The resulting publicity from Bay's heroism brings him to the attention of a private...
Jackie Chan done smash some bad guys.
He gone done them good. But he basically catches the attention of a private investigator who informs him that he is actually the long-lost son of a wealthy businessman. In the hope of reuniting him with his true family, Bay travels to Korea where his father lies dying. Bay finds that both his parents actually lived the life he longed for. They were both professional spies. Now drawn into a dangerous game of cat and mouse where no one could be trusted, Bay travels to Turkey. It's soon up to him to track down a new, highly addictive narcotic called Anthrax 2 before it ends up in the hands of evil drug lords.
Man, that film sounds rubbish.
Now, let's see, the first line I've actually got for this is written and said, this is why I love Jackie Chan films. Because actually, when you read that plot there, is it right? It actually sounds like some sort of drama to the very last line where it's and now the cat and mouse game begins where you have to travel a highly addictive narcotics from drug lords.
Evil.
It's like they forgot to add action. But I blame the person on IMDb that wrote this plot.
When I listen to it, it sounds more like a Hollywood film. Found out he had two long-lost like nephews in America. And he had to go some kind of adventurous romp with them. And that would fit in perfectly.
Mm-hmm. But, yep, yeah, it's got all these elements of why I love Jackie Chan films. The opening scenes where he's working in the exercise equipment store. He's demonstrating all his skills, and it's just Jackie Chan showing off how bloody cool he is. Like, how you get the exercise balls. He's rolling over it, throwing out 50 new moves. Like, exercise routines. Like, you could do this. And he's sitting flipping around and this, rolling around on it. And then he's on other gym equipment, lifting himself up, and he's doing flips on trampolines. And then it comes to him foiling the bank robbery, where he's suspect. Well, obviously, he has this gut feeling to everything. Like, when he's in the store, he gets a gut feeling, he's like, I think people's going to come into the shop soon. Bang, right enough, people come into the shop. And it's the same when he predicts the robbery. And of course, it just turns into, like, the great, like, late 90s Jackie Chan, where it's, who am I, Mr. Nice Guy, where he just suddenly turns into action mode and he fucking finds everything around him, uses it on the bad guys and saves the day.
And it's great. That sounds quite good.
Mm-hmm.
That should be the synopsis.
Exactly. And it also co-stars Eric Tsang, who is like the private investigator, that kind of...
And who was briefly in Anna Magdalena as well.
There we go.
Yeah.
We're all linking up, Stu.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just one of these things where, sure, the story seems a bit daft, but is the action makes up for everything. When this film was made, it is amongst the other twilight of Jackie Chan films where America repackaged it and like flung it out. Just as like, hey, it's Jackie Chan, it's the Rush Hour guy, it's the Rumble in the Bronx guy. Like, here's more for you. Like, it's in the same line of movies as First Strike, Who Am I, Mr. Nice Guy, where, sure, movies were probably originally done in Cantonese, but they're redubbed by Jackie. And there's even actually portions of The Accidental Spy where he is speaking English, but for the international release, they redone the dubbing over those scenes anyway. Hmm. There's actually footage, they've actually dubbed the outtakes at the end into English.
How silly. Mm-hmm. They actually apparently redubbed the international version, so there's no mention of Anthrax, because this was obviously made in 2001, and the movie was released on DVD not too long after that, so it's way too close to 9/11. So yeah, there's no mention of Anthrax in the international version.
Mm-hmm. Also, isn't this new designer drug supposed to be something people want to take?
Yes.
Why would you call it Anthrax then?
Well,
Anthrax, I reckon,
it's pretty stupid.
It's got two at the end.
Yeah, so.
So that just makes obviously, two. Obviously the sequel's better.
Two. That's script writing.
So call it Sex Junk. Yeah. So that's a bad name already. Anthrax.
Former Category 3 star Vivian Hsu is in this also. She's the leading lady. Mm-hmm. Taiwanese actress.
I don't know if I just... It was one of these films where I'd kind of just somehow got this opinion that it was going to be poop, or I've read reviews where it said it's poop.
Yeah, it does
just
have an
average rating. I didn't think it was going to be poop.
Mm-hmm. But I reckon, I think this is just... Like, when watching it, it's just... It's got all the reasons why I love Jackie Chan movies. Like, it's got his creative action style. It's got crazy stunts. There's car... There's always, like, a vehicle stunt where there's, like, a police car going over two normal cars and it lands down on the hoods. A lot of vehicle stunts, explosions, Jackie Chan jumping off the side of a bridge and a truck goes off the bridge. It's just action-packed.
All right, Stu, I've got something for you.
Okay.
Take Who Am I?
Yep.
Mr. Nice Guy?
Yep.
Rumble in the Bronx?
Mm-hmm.
First Strike?
Yep.
An Accidental Spy? And put them into a top five. Reverse order.
Mm. Probably Mr. Nice Guy.
In fifth?
Yep.
Okay.
In fourth... what was the other four again? But Who Am I? First Strike. Accidental Spy. What's the other one?
Rumble in the Bronx.
Let's put Rumble in the Bronx in fourth. First Strike could go fourth.
Yeah.
Then Rumble in the Bronx, then Accidental Spy, then Who Am I?
Interesting.
I'm a big fan of Who Am I.
Yeah, I didn't really like that film. I'd probably have it the table almost the opposite way around.
Mm-hmm. So, it was the way I saw them. That was the one that stood out the most for me. Sure, it's a bit crazy. He's up in his always, like his face paint. He's running about in the desert and all that junk. But still, it's just my favourite one.
Doesn't this have Accidental Spy, one of these crappy Western actresses that somehow managed to grace Jackie Chan films? You know, with the report I remember from the beginning, or that was just a small role. I just remember. I'm mixing it up with Who Am I? I think there's a redhead reporter.
Aye, there's a redhead reporter, and Who Am I?
Yeah, she's pretty crap, I remember.
Yeah, that's what I was saying to Mike last week, when it is one of those actresses that's just seems to have done that only one Jackie Chan film. I think Jackie Chan is easily blackmailed.
Yeah, that's what we said before. Mm-hmm. He just meets a girl in a bar. Hey, baby, want to be in the movies?
I think it's all the way about. I think they get him drunk and take pictures of him naked, then blackmail.
That's only good for one film.
See, I think that's how Eric San got in this movie as well.
Because he's rarely in movies. You know, the only scene I remember from Accidental Spy, I remember like thinking, oh, this is decent. I never watched it again, probably like 7 or 9 years, well, 7 or 8 years since I watched it. But I remember the Turkish bathhouse fight scene was kind of fun. Mm-hmm. If that was even a fight scene, I just remember him sliding across the floor.
Yeah, but you see him when outtakes where he takes a bad slip and cracks his head.
Yeah, I mean, he only has a towel on, so obviously mm-hmm. they can't pat him too much, or rather they can't pat him at all aside from the towel.
All right, I think that is our last movie is covered. So, for people not familiar with Ivyhoe...
Well, they are now.
They are now. let's see, we do have a Wikipedia page up here of Ivyhoe. Now, her work did start back in 1986 with a movie.
Take My Legs to My Balls.
That was the name of the movie. The English title is...
It was a serious romance comedy. A serious romance, no comedy. I think it's also the prequel to The Age of Miracles.
Which movie are we talking about?
What Mike goes on about.
Okay, sorry.
Okay. Basically, her first movie, because from the looks of Wikipedia providing us the information, saying that in 1986 she wrote Silent Love. And if you do, good, because if you do follow that link, it does take you to a song called Silent Love. So you're right, that's no help at all.
The early Lau Ching Wan movie that was released by Joy Sales on DVD. It's DVD debut like this year. So finally people can see Silent Love. It's a pretty solid film.
See, it's like, who needs Wikipedia when you have Wankipedia?
Wankipedia, what was that?
No, it just had Ken in the middle.
Ah.
See, you're our Wikipedia.
Yeah, he called you Kenju last time.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yep. Stu, you big anti-Semite.
Fuck you, Banner. Anyway, in 1996, she wrote...
You're Wankipedia!
Comrades, Almost a Love Story.
Oh, that's a good film.
That was the first one I saw. Age of Miracles also followed in the same year. Ken?
Bad.
Starring?
Adam fucking Tam.
Okay. As Mike Banner mentioned, Anna Maddaliagia.
Magdalena.
Yes. I was actually referring to the Italian source material.
Ooh, his librarian flashing his knowledge here.
Aye, so that was in 1998. In the year 2000, she also wrote And I Hate You So, starring Aaron Kwok, and I think Kelly Chen as well.
Yeah.
I have seen the trailer for that once or twice, and I'd actually quite fancy to look at that one, because I think that's where he actually played a disc jockey.
Yeah, I think.
A DJ.
Yeah, radio. I think it's set around a radio station.
Third time right.
And how old did you sign then, Stuart?
He played
the disc jockey, spinning those records the kids like.
No, just I think when I say disc jockey, I think cock jockeys. I just made him actually sound like a big whore.
Fuck.
So I was like, right.
No. You're a strange, strange man indeed.
And he tapes his balls to his legs as well.
Fuck you, cunts. Okay. You know, we are actually giving this podcast out to other people. There's going to have to be two copies of this.
the tape your balls to your legs edition and the up edition.
Yeah, because the people that organised the festival at Corner House are wanting a copy of the podcast to put on their website to distribute for the people as well as the interview. In 2001, as mentioned earlier, she wrote The Accidental Spy. Of course, big Jackie Chan vehicle. 2002 was July Rhapsody, which Paul Alden did write about extensively on the website. Ken's film, the 2003 Goddess of Mercy.
Yep, I made that film.
In 2005 was the Aaron Kwok, Daniel Wu and Eakin Cheng flick, Divergence.
And in short... What's your verdict on that one? Good, bad, half and half, very good, excellent, good, right?
Mm-hmm. In 2008, she wrote both Linger and Claustrophobia. Also in 2008, she was the director for Claustrophobia. 2009, she has also written and directed Crossing Hennessy, which stars Daniel Wu, scroll up the page, Jackie Chung, Tang Wei, Danny Lee, and Maggie Chung Ho Yi.
Yeah, that's another one. Did you say Danny Lee, Mr. Lee, sir?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
And let's see, she's also responsible for the stories of Gorgeous, To Become One, and obviously Claustrophobia. So, basically, yep. If you want more information, we'll put up the Wikipedia link to Ivyhoe's profile.
And I just want to mention briefly that she's won the Hong Kong Film Award twice for her writing Comrades Almost a Love Story and July Rhapsody.
I think IMDb lists her for winning... Oh, she has won 5 Best Screenplay Awards. Let's see. 2 at the Hong Kong Film Festival. 1 Golden... what the hell is that word?
Bahinga.
Award. Also a Golden Horse. And most recently, for Claustrophobia, she won Best Screenplay at the Hong Kong Film Critics Society Awards. And obviously, if you haven't checked out our review of Claustrophobia yet, please go on over to podcastonfire.com, where Paul has done a sterling job. So, before we lead you guys into the interview, I would like to give out a big thanks to Rosie Farrell, Sarah Perks, Charlotte Pedley, Anne Lee Willis, Ivyhoe, and many, many thanks to Paul for his great help covering the season on the website.
Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, well done, Paul.
And now, here comes the interview.
Okay, I'm now sat in Corner House Bar, and sitting across from me is director, writer, Ivyhoe.
My pleasure.
We were just chatting about some of the films that have been on as part of the Visible Secret season. Last week, I had the pleasure of watching Claustrophobia, as well as, and before that, July Rhapsody. And I believe you had some input into Jackie Chan's movie Gorgeous. Can you tell me something about that?
Oh, well, I did actually. Well, I was involved in 2 movies with Jackie Chan in it. One is Gorgeous, and the other one is The Accidental Spy.
Yeah.
And I've seen Accidental Spy, but I've never seen Gorgeous. Right. The thing is, I'm supposed to come up with well, both times are actually quite accidental, because I never intentionally write anything for deliberately for Jackie Chan.
Yeah.
I think in the case of Gorgeous, I cannot remember because it happened quite a while ago. And Jackie Chan wanted to do something not so martial art.
Yeah, yeah.
So he wants to try his hands on a milder kind of cinema.
Yeah.
So I came up with something like a message in the bottle kind of scenario.
Yeah.
I wrote the first draft.
Yeah.
But then they hired a director on board who I understood also wrote himself.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, you know, if you, because originally they are supposed to hire another director, but then since he's on board, I know there would be conflicts, you know, writers, and they have their own idea of how the movie should go or that sort of thing. So I just came up with the first draft.
Yeah.
And then it's up to them or to him.
Yeah.
To change it.
Yeah, I read that originally it wasn't meant to be a Jackie Chan movie at all. He wasn't going to star in it.
It's something like that.
Yeah.
You know, whenever... what I heard is one of his projects sort of go to the ground. So he has to... Because he's have reserved a slot for that movie. And since it can't be done, so... Obviously, he wanted to make something out of the time I mean, his time is precious. So that was the those days when he was busy flying between Hong Kong and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Doing Hollywood movies. So I think Golden Harvest want to make use of the time.
Mm. Yeah.
So they want me to come up with a more a romance with some kung fu in it.
That brings me nicely onto one of my questions. Do you feel more at home with dramas like Comrades, Almost a Love Story, and July Rhapsody, or are you just as happy writing for action movies or even darker films like Goddess of Mercy?
To tell you the truth, I'm quite fed up with writing romance.
Right.
But that's right. The role they gave to women writers.
Mm.
I mean, yeah. It seems that, you know, all over the world, people feel women should have their place, which is
right.
Write more drama, more feminine kind of storylines, romance. I want to try my hands on thrillers, detective stories, like that. But in Hong Kong, it's either drama means shaky grounds, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You either your film is romance or is action, which covers kung fu as well.
Yeah,
it's either this or that.
Yeah.
So there's no in between. There's no gray areas.
Mm.
So thriller happens to be a gray area.
Yeah.
Because for thriller to do without gunfire or martial arts is, I mean, I can understand that because the audience in Hong Kong usually reserve that for Hollywood movies. They might like to see a Hollywood-made thriller, but those made in Hong Kong, not so good. So I find it hard to. I always try to make some thrillers.
Mm.
I actually did. A Benny Chan movie, Divergence, is not so action-packed. It's more of a story-oriented kind of drama.
Yeah.
But I also understand the thing that, you know, Hong Kong-made movies are not well-known as being very plot-oriented. You need to pack in actions and that sort of thing. So I can't say Divergence is very successful, although it was sold in the States, it's DVD rights, so it was available in the form of DVD in the States. But box office-wise, it's not doing very well.
Yeah.
Some people criticize the movie as being too complicated. Well, that is another thing, because at that time, the company who's doing this wants to put all three lead male cast in the movie. They want to pack all three into one.
Yeah.
Those are sort of well-known movie stars who they have contracted. I don't know. Because, you know, for some kung fu or some action movies, there isn't any storyline at all. I mean, what you need to do is just come up with a gimmick, and then write an outline, and every like 8 minutes there is an excuse for action, that sort of thing. I don't think I can help a lot in that kind of situation. So if you want to hire me to write an action movie, I would try to inject a little bit more plot twist in it, or characterization. Otherwise, it's no fun.
So, bearing in mind that it's action movies are the ones that really do well overseas, what does it mean to you to have claustrophobia showing in somewhere like Manchester?
I don't know. I remember when I was in San Francisco, the San Francisco Film Festival, they're saying, you know, meet the two sides of Hong Kong. Because at that time, The Beast Doctor, you know, you heard about that film?
Yeah,
Hong Kong-made action movie.
Right.
We always go everywhere together. I don't know why. Beast Doctor and Claustrophobia. Mm. We were in Berlin at the same time, and then we went to San Francisco. And they're saying, come see the two faces of Hong Kong cinema. I don't know. Now that Hong Kong cinema are past its heyday, it's getting more and more difficult to finance, you know, non-action projects. We have to do it with very low budget.
Yeah.
And I can say, I want to say I'm proud that finally I've done something with that sort of budget, and also as an alternative to the kind of things that the overseas audience expect.
Yeah. I think that like an action film, Claustrophobia also has universal meanings. Like any office worker around the world could relate could relate to the story. Was that deliberate?
Yes, it's actually based on my life, my past incarnation as an office goer. I've been going to the office for a long, long time before I quit and become a freelance writer.
Right.
You know what? You know, most people have to go to office. There are not a lot of factories these days. But you know what the definition of an office is. Mm. And you have your office TV series, right?
Yeah.
And it's quite boring.
Yeah.
When you get bored, you know, it's time to be nosy. Mm. To turn,
wanders.
You know, gossips into entertainment.
Yeah.
And, I mean, what can be better to sort of monitor and gossip about, you know, your colleagues' lives or doing a lot of guesswork. You know, I think Albert is in love with Georgina, that sort of thing. But, you know, you can only whisper.
Yeah.
You gossip, you talk about it, you monitor them, you keep an eye, but you can never ask them.
Mm.
Now, are you two really have a thing going on?
Yeah.
Especially if either of them is married or have a steady companion.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know. But that sort of thing spice up your life in the office. It's like wallpaper.
Yeah.
You can't live without that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's like a tea break.
Mm.
A tea break is not a real tea break without any gossip.
Yeah.
So that sort of affairs make the best kind of gossip.
Mm.
And it's just natural.
Yeah. I enjoyed some of the subtleties in Claustrophobia. Even the scene where Ikin Cheng removes his tie and there's a very subtle glance from Karina Lam. You can tell that she has some infatuation.
I never intend to tell the audience exactly what goes on.
Yeah.
Because I want the audience to be to be just like a fellow colleague.
Yeah.
Look at it that way. I mean, you don't dare to confront or to ask them explicitly.
Mm.
Have you gone to bed with him? No, it's not civilized.
Mm.
It's not proper.
Mm.
So, I think, I mean, if I didn't say it laid out so plainly, you would have to do the guesswork yourself. Mm. I don't know, some people say, you know, you don't have any storyline in the movie, in the sense that it's all vignettes and they expect to have, you know, now that they are in love, they should go to bed and then they have a fallout and then they have a confrontation and then there's tragedies, that sort of thing.
Mm.
I offer none of that.
Mm.
So some are disappointed.
Yeah.
I know that. Because also the name in Chinese is misleading. Actually, the name in Chinese reads intimacy.
Mm. Oh, right.
But I'm talking about intimacy.
Mm.
Not in the ordinary sense.
Mm.
In the sense that you are in a cramped office.
Mm.
You have to be intimate with each other.
Yeah.
There's intimacy in a different sense.
Yeah. So I kind of spotted actual, what I thought I was seeing, claustrophobia in the scene where they're all stuck in the lift. You've got Eric Sang's goldfish in an overpopulated fish tank.
In a car.
And then, yeah, then again, later on, she's trapped in a taxi with a rainstorm outside.
And also, on top of all that, we deliberately look for a very crammed office setting.
Yeah.
But in Hong Kong, most of the offices are like that.
Yeah.
Because the rent is so high.
Mm.
People have to work in very tiny cubicles.
Yeah.
Or no cubicles at all, just face to face.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very sort of miserable situation.
Claustrophobia uses a split narrative device where the viewer is taken progressively back in time. Can I ask what influenced you in making that decision?
I mean, going in retro.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think it works like how our memory works. Now, if you are like, now at the end of the first scene, where you know Karina was given a signal to leave the company.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Naturally, she would feel very upset.
Mm.
She would be very frustrated.
Yeah.
And now ask yourself, if you are so frustrated, when you go home, you will say, "Now, damn. I shouldn't. Why hadn't I gone through the motion a year ago when I have already typed the resignation letter?"
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you regret the decision. Of course, at the end, the audience knew nothing about that decision.
Mm.
But your mind, now that you are faced with a very frustrating situation.
Yeah.
Your mind obviously go back. What have I done wrong?
Yeah.
What have I done to deserve this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you go back.
Mm.
Back and back and back until you find the moment where you think your problem actually comes from.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, our mind goes back in random kind of way.
Mm.
It may not be in a linear, retrospective manner.
Mm.
Sometimes it jumps back and forth or irrationally.
Yeah, yeah.
But I need to be more rational in that sense, or the audience will lose my story.
Yeah.
Now, I just saw another film which, you know, goes like this, which is 500 Days of Summer.
Right.
And it goes randomly.
Mm.
The memory goes back and forth in a very random kind of way. But that story is a simple love story.
Mm.
So maybe they can afford to do it that way.
Yeah.
But what I'm talking about here is just not exactly a romance. It's actually, what I want to say is an involuntary affair.
Mm.
Or if you, well, it may not be a fair at all. Nobody knows exactly what goes on between the two, the man and the woman there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a lot of guesswork. It's actually an observation.
Yeah.
A very common observation. I do believe most people have that experience.
Mm.
Either you are involved in an office affair or you are an observer.
Mm.
Of that sort of situation.
Yeah.
So I want to do that, and I want to just suggest, why has the office affair become so popular?
Mm.
Why is it so common? I can't supply any satisfactory answer.
Yeah.
But then I'm just guessing.
Mm.
This is just one way to make life in the office tolerable.
So was the movie written in chronological order, or was it written specifically in these bite-sized chunks?
It was written in backward manner.
Right.
Just like what you are seeing on screen.
Yeah.
But at one point, we did ask ourselves, should we make it more comprehensible for the audience?
Mm.
It's all very easy to put them back chronologically.
Yeah.
But the whole coin would be lost.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be easier for the, much easier. It would be more user-friendly, I know. Mm. But the whole coin is gone.
Yeah.
There will be no more suspense.
Yeah.
Okay. At the last scene, when you see the letter of resignation, you would maybe, oh, is that so?
Yeah.
If you reverse the narrative, a lot of suspense will be lost.
Yeah.
But then maybe people say, you know, I don't really need that much suspense. After all, I come here to see a romance.
Yeah.
So it's a bit, a dilemma. Suspense and romance may not gel. You know, they may not go hand in hand.
Yeah.
But I think it's nice to try.
It's a nice combination.
I mean, every movie can use some suspense. That's my belief. Because you cannot... I think what I don't believe is... Now, you may be telling the audience an ordinary story, but you cannot let them know for sure which direction you're going.
Yeah.
I mean, you cannot just, you know, be predicted.
Yeah.
You know, in your every move.
Yeah.
That would be a failure, I think, from the point of view of a writer. And so, well, I thought the boss is going to think, well, why don't you put it back chronologically? But no, he didn't do that. So
yeah.
I'm happy the way it came out.
Yeah. When you say the boss, who?
The owner of the film.
Right. Anyone we know?
Bill Kong. Bill Kong, well, he's a very famous film producer.
Yeah.
He did Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Right.
And also Last Caution. And a lot of kung fu stunts, The Curse of the Yellow Flower.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. He does a lot of mega budget productions.
Yeah.
I think mine is the cheapest production he's ever financed. Now this was actually made under Irresistible Film, which is a joint venture between Bill Kong and the Japanese company AVAX. Now this fund was set up to promote to finance projects generated by first timers.
Was the transition from writing to directing an easy one?
No, it's not easy. Otherwise I could have become a director years ago. I know it's not that easy. And also I think I've passed the time to be a first-time director. I was thinking about it way back when I feel very frustrated when a director changed my script.
Right.
In a very weird... You know, you don't like changes. You don't like other people to...
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
All writers are selfish. They don't want other people to change the script. I know, you know, the director is bound to change, to make some changes. If I don't want people to change my script, I can either become a novelist or to, you know, try directing it.
Yeah.
But directing it is, in my point of view, quite a difficult job.
Yeah.
You know, my first job is a production assistant. I remember that was when I was 20. Every time the light man changed the light, I fell asleep.
Right.
So I know I wasn't cut out to be a director. You need to be visually sensitive.
Yeah.
And you need to choreograph your shots. You need to have that sort of sense. But then again, when I look at all these, a lot of Hong Kong directors, well, their shots are quite good. They have good visual sense, but then their stories are horrible. So I was asking myself, which is more important? A good storyline, a good script, or, you know, good shots, good composition, good visual composition? So I keep asking these questions. But then, I also... I'm convinced that if you can write, if you can write a proper story, if you come up with good lines, that make you are already halfway there, because that means, that also means you can direct your actors and actresses how to deliver those lines and how to execute the scenarios. So I have that edge over the visually oriented kind of directors. Because I think, you know, it's good to see great shots, brilliant views. Everybody can use some brilliance in that sense. But if the story is empty or very cliché or it's going nowhere, I don't know. I remember when I was younger, I watched a lot of French movies. Sometimes French movies are made in a very simple form. I mean, of course, their shots are good. But then, you know, it doesn't need a lot of shots to get across the story. And also, claustrophobia comes as, it's a call. It's a wake-up call to me. I keep, you know, thinking whether or not I should become a director. At one point, I told myself I gave up because I'm too old. I'm not as energetic, and my knees are breaking down. I sometimes feel pain in my knees. So, you know, how can you become a director when it's a job that requires a lot of energy? But then claustrophobia presents a chance in itself, in a sense that I didn't write the script from to become a director. I wrote it for another director. But I spent a lot of time. It started off as a game. You see, the director told me, give me some pawns. You know, a few pawns, like, you know, a woman goes to a pier to wait for her boyfriend. But that boyfriend never show up. It's one pawn. And then there is a taxi caught in a storm, in the flood. It causes the engine to break down, and the passenger and the driver were stranded. So from there you come up with a storyline, which has to be a romance, and low budget. I spent a long time trying to figure out, well, to me this is a very interesting game. You need to fill in the blanks, but then sometimes the game can be quite tough to overcome. So I spent a long time trying to figure out how I'm going to play a game, and then I suddenly, I want to say, I'm turning the table, because I have been nurturing in my mind to write an involuntary kind of romance, and also the wrestling between a man and a woman. You did see the wrestling, right? The wrestling meaning, you know, sometimes in a couple, you don't, I mean, neither one wants to be the first to confess their feeling. You're waiting for the other party to do something, right? You're waiting. You're always waiting. So it's some kind of a wrestling. So one day I think, I suddenly thought, why can't I turn this story into something like this? But then, after I finished the script, I spent a lot of time, and I take a pay cut because, you know, the director said it has to be a low-budget production, so I can't give you your regular fees. And a year after I finished the script, it's still there, waiting to be shot. And I know that, you know, it would never be shot. So I bought it back and found a boss to finance. And the rest is history. And when I think back now, it looked like a dream. Because I don't know what prompted me to make certain decisions. It's just like the hero and the heroine in the story. You want to you want to figure out exactly when and where you had that decision. But then it's too late now because a lot of things has happened since then. And I remember the worst part is we shot it in winter, which is last January. I mean, January 2008.
Yeah.
And it was a very, very cold winter.
Mm.
Very cold. I mean, it's nothing for you, but in Hong Kong, it's bitter cold.
Yeah.
So it's very hard because we are always shooting on the road in a car.
Yeah.
So it's very, very
now I really
difficult.
Appreciate the scenes in the rain.
And in the rain, yes.
Yeah.
I have to give credit to Karina.
Yeah.
He has to pretend it's summer.
Right.
Because that's where the typhoon comes in. In winter, we don't have any storm.
Right.
So it has to be from summer. And he wears such thin clothes.
More or less full creative control must have been a cathartic experience.
I think as the edge of a writer, a writer turned director, is you can make all the last minute changes.
Mm.
I mean, because sometimes you don't necessarily get everything you conceive.
Yeah.
For instance, an actor may get sick, or he may quit, he may disappear, he may not want to do certain scenes the way you wanted it, or the location is simply not available, or your budget doesn't permit you to do that sort of thing. I think the edge of a writer in directing is he can very easily change it. That's my selling point. I keep saying, you know, I'm the bloody writer myself. I can change it overnight.
Yeah.
No problem. So I see that as a game, you know. A lot of things would look happier and more pleasant to you if you treat it as a game.
Mm.
You see, all these are obstacles. In a game, of course, there are obstacles.
Yeah.
The whole point is how you overcome those obstacles. Or sometimes you lose. But what's so unusual? You sometimes lose. So, but there has to be a way. So if you look at it as a game,
yeah,
I think that's how I look at it.
Prior to July Rhapsody in 2001, Jackie Chung had been away from the movie scene for several years. And again, Crossing Hennessy brings him back to the movies after even more time away.
It's actually not true. He gets appeared in a lot of movies.
Right.
Maybe he's not in a leading role, but then he was in a lot of movies. But then, you know, he was a singer. He's a very popular singer.
Yeah, yeah.
And he also have a family now with two girls, so maybe he wants to spend more time with his family.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's not, he doesn't appear as frequent as in the past.
Right.
That's true.
Did you have Jackie Chung in mind when you conceived July Rhapsody and Crossing Hennessy?
Not really. But I think I can't remember. You know, as a writer, you shouldn't really have someone in mind because that was risky. If that someone cannot be in, then your whole project would be very seriously affected. So, vaguely, you know, he fits the role.
Yeah.
I must say. And having him on board is maybe one of the best things that happens to July Rhapsody.
Yeah.
He was really good.
Mm.
I wrote Crossing Hennessy a few years ago. This was the one and only speculative script I've written.
Yeah.
And when I wrote that, I don't have anybody in particular in mind. The reason why I took up this idea is I was inspired by a Russian movie I saw 10, 15 years ago, the character is quite famous. The movie is derived from a Russian novel called Oblomov.
Mm.
He's a lazy guy.
Right.
A very lazy guy, but a guy who's smart enough to know that he is too lazy to lead an ordinary life. He knows, so he's not dumb.
Right.
You know, I know I'm lazy, so I don't want to get people hurt. I cannot get married, because if I get married, I'm ruining my wife.
Right.
So he is that kind of a person.
Yeah.
And I find it very interesting, because now I'm quite against the typical kind of feel good movie where you are handicapped, you are a loser, but then you try hard.
Yeah.
And you overcome all the problems, and at the end you get the girl you wanted, you get the job you wanted, you get promoted, you get your lottery ticket.
Yeah.
I think it's quite unresponsible. I mean, because people, like, you know, there are a lot of terminal cancer story. Like, if you try harder, you would be free of that disease.
Yeah.
It's not an attitude.
Yeah.
I appreciate.
You don't like this idea of giving.
So I just want to say, it's okay to be ordinary. Most people are not too hardworking.
Yeah.
Or they shouldn't be encouraged to work harder than they should. I don't know. I just feel tired about going to all these motivational kind of feel good movies.
Yeah.
You know, try harder. You would win. You would get your way eventually.
Yeah.
No, I hate that. So, and Oblomov happened to be a reversal of that sort of story.
Right.
And well, there are two kinds. Either you work hard, or you are lucky enough. There are some kind of typical Hollywood comedy where an ugly, bad character always, you know, happy-go-lucky, and then he gets everything he wants without trying, without really being good. And so either way, it's either this or that.
Yeah.
So, but I always need to portray a more realistic situation. No. Most people are not too handsome, not too bright, not too hardworking. They're just ordinary. I don't know. People say, yeah, this sounds disastrous, because, you know, people, the audience doesn't want to look at movies like that.
Yeah.
That depicts realism. Realism is something they don't want to go. If they want realism, why can't they pick a documentary?
Yeah.
But I think there must be a balance in between.
I think there's a general consensus that people go to the cinema for escapism.
But how much escapism can you endure? Do you need? Or, I mean, you can see, you appreciate Transformer or maybe Batman.
Mm.
But maybe you want to change somehow after seeing so many Batman and Transformer and or maybe Walt Disney.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to be able to steal the space in between two escapist movies. Yeah, I'm trying to steal between the shows. I think some movies deserve an opportunity. I try hard to be given that opportunity. And mine is not... I mean, I know, of course, there are also all kinds of realist... movies that I wouldn't like to go to see.
Yeah.
So I don't think mine is that realistic, that realist. But I want to do a more realist observation. It always has a storyline. But then, from time to time, I always want to do some fable, some fairy tales.
Yeah. I think life itself throws up surreal situations, whether we like it or not.
Yes, fairy tales are good, but fairy tales. Well, if what we are talking about is, you know, Harry Potter thing, it's not cheap. So.
Yeah. Okay, on behalf of Podcast on Fire, I'd like to thank Ivy Ho, who's been tremendous throughout this interview.
It's a pleasure talking to you too.